I didn't know you were leaving. Well, you certainly knew I would leave one day. Yes, but I came back and you were just gone. It was time, Davood. She was stiff as a deck board, her face emotionless. Davood had rarely felt so awkward. Have you heard the news? About Bella? For the first time, her hard expression softened, but not as much as Davood would have guessed, especially given how close she and Bella had been. Yes, I heard. Might I come in? He asked. Perhaps another time. Davood waved down the hall toward their old room. It's only... there's a page missing from the book Sukru gave me. He paused, waiting for her to admit that she had taken it. But Anila only shook her head. I don't know anything about that. It was in the book you were looking at. She gave him a shrug, the sort children gave their parents when they were tired of being asked questions. Ask the maids. Beyond Anila was a large table, and on its surface, beside a number of open books, a birdcage. What's that? Davood, I'm really quite busy. The sound Davood had heard earlier, it had been wings flapping, he realized, not the pages of a book. He pushed his way past her and entered the room. As he came closer to the table, he saw the firefinch lying lifeless on the cage's floor. What happened? Anila closed the door and approached with a distinct limp. It died. That's the bird that came to my patio. The one that brought the golden triangle, and with it the mage known as the Sparrow. But he couldn't tell Anila that. The one you were staring at so intently. And? He rounded on her. Why is it here? She shrugged. I liked it. They're not so difficult to catch. But it's dead now. Gods, the heat from the nearby fireplace was stifling. Anila smiled. Then she reached across the table, picked up the cage, and set it before Davood. No, it isn't. To his surprise, the finch was now standing on the floor among the shit and wood shavings, blinking, its wings shivering as if it were clearing sand from its back. It took wing and alighted on a branch in the upper reaches of the cage. Unlike the times he'd seen it on the patio, it now looked and acted quite like a normal bird. It blinked, taking in its surroundings with quick swivels of its head. And as Davood moved his hand closer, it chirped excitedly, flitting about the cage. But it was just lying there, he said, lowering his hand, not moving. Perhaps the heat was too much for it, Anila said easily. Now, if you please, I have work to do. What work? He motioned to the books. Did King Sukru give you these? Well, who else would have? But why? Are you conducting experiments on that finch? Her expression turned grim. What if I am? He reached for the handle of the cage. She tried to stop him, but her movements were dulled and pain-filled, and he snatched it away. Experiments of what sort? He asked, holding the cage up before him to examine the finch. I seem to remember you making it perfectly clear I was not to interfere in your work. I couldn't ask a question without you lording your power over me. You've no right to pry into my business. Now, if you please. She motioned to the cage. Set that down and leave. He couldn't. The finch tied him to the sparrow. He wasn't sure if Anila knew about the link, but he couldn't leave it to chance. He made for the door, cage in hand. Davood! He kept walking, closing the door with a clatter behind him. Back in his room, he rushed to the patio and opened the cage. The bird fluttered up to the fig tree. Davood chased after it, waving his arms like a fool. Don't return, he whispered to it. Not when she's near, do you hear me? A moment later the finch was gone, and a terrible chill went down Davood's spine. He had just remembered the missing page from the book. It had contained the sigil for death. 2 days later, Davood was summoned to join King Sukru in a short journey down the mountain to the Sun Palace. He went to the grand entrance, where two covered Arabas waited in the carriage circle. He was just climbing the stairs into the cabin of the first carriage when he realized it wasn't empty. Anila was sitting on one of the benches, a blue scarf around her head, matching her long patterned dress and strapped leather sandals. She looked defiant, not toward him, but the world. A part of him was pleased to see her again, but given where they were about to go...
"Did Sukru ask you to come?" Davood asked.
"And a good day to you as well."
Davood shook his head, embarrassed.
"I'm sorry. It's only... I was surprised to see you."
When she said nothing, he went on.
"Did he, Anila, summon you?"
She released a pent-up breath.
"Breath of the desert, you're exasperating, Davood."
She looked as if she were about to say more when her attention was caught by something outside the window. Davood turned and saw four kings walking down the palace steps toward the second wagon. Sukru, bent and aged. Kahil, who looked nearly as young as Davood. Husamitin, the king of swords, and the imposing form of Kiral, king of kings.
"Gods," Davood thought. "Four of them."
Clearly the vision he had stumbled upon of the strange cavern was much more important than he had guessed.
"Has it ever occurred to you," Anila went on, "that Sukru values my opinion? You've a brilliant mind, and you would be a valuable asset, a keen advisor in any king's court. It's a pity you don't think the same of me."
The carriage lurched into motion, the kings having entered behind them. Around the carriage circle they went. When they'd passed beyond the palace walls, the amber sand met a sky of hazy blue. With a steep drop-off on their left, they followed King's Road, the whole of Sharakai sprawled below them.
"I do think the same of you," Davood said. "You know that."
Jaw jutting, Anila stared out her window.
"How I tire of men who speak with words and never deeds."
She had bandages around her wrists and ankles. Her elbows were ashen grey and flaking, as were the spots along her neck, below her ears. But otherwise she looked as whole as she would ever be. Davood could see how much it still pained her, though. Even small movements on the bench made her grimace. Anila had never been one to admit or show weakness, and the tendency had intensified since Ishmantep. The indefatigable courage in her eyes were sharper, on display more often. He wanted to tell her all this, but she had nearly died because of him. He had no doubt she would prove to be a valuable advisor to any of the kings, but he couldn't willingly aid her desire to follow in his path.
"I don't need your ruddy permission,"
she spat at him, guessing his mind.
"Nor your approval. I'll find my way to power with or without you."
When he made no reply, she made a disgusted sound and leaned heavily into her seat, refusing to look at him. The ride passed in cold silence. The Araba went lower along the mountain, coming nearer and nearer to their destination, the Sun Palace.
"Anila,"
Davood pinched the bridge of his nose. Why was this so difficult? With Amalas gone, hadn't he said how much he wanted someone he could confide in?
"When the gods saw fit to put us together on that ship, when Hamzakir finally granted me my plea, and we ended up together, I thought it meant something."
Davood could see Anila chewing the inside of her lip, something she did when she was nervous.
"What did you think it meant?" "That we were supposed to be together. It's why I was so hurt
when you paid more attention to Tayar than me.
I told you that was because...
I know, to gain his trust.
Tayar was the man tasked with ensuring their return to Sharakai. She had gained his trust, and later used it to lure him into the desert and drive a ruddy great stone against his skull.
I don't blame you for it. And when we escaped and reached Ishmantep, I was sure the gods were ready to reward us, but they stole it all away. Stole your life from you. Your future. Stole our future together.
For a long while, Anila was silent. Higher on Toriat, the bells of the dawning sun began to ring.
Our future doesn't have to be lost.
She was right.
Of course she was right. I had a vision, he blurted, picking at his fingernails.
He couldn't seem to look at her. He felt more than saw Anila shift in her seat.
What?
It's what I've been doing for Sukru. He found diseased Adhikara in the blooming fields and asked me to accompany him to try to learn more.
He lifted his head and found her staring at him in wonder, silent, as if she didn't want to break the spell. He answered her unspoken question.
I found something. Something big, I think. Though I don't yet understand it.
What?
She asked again.
I felt the disease within those trees, but I felt their history as well. I saw them being born at Tulathan's touch. I saw Nalame come to them, and then fight with Gojan for her life. Most disconcerting, though, was their very nature.
What do you mean?
The Adhikara are not separate, Anila. I felt the roots connecting, coming together like the tributaries of a vast river system. They're all one being, and they meet below the city.
Fingers still picking at his nail, he shot a glance through the window toward the Sun Palace.
I suspect that's where we're going today. They want to see it with their own eyes.
Anila's eyes went distant.
The Adhikara?
Yes.
The coach rattled as they passed over the short bridge leading to the Sun Palace. The sun was blocked as they entered through the barbican.
What is it, Anila?
She shook her head.
What did Sukru tell you?
Only that I was to come and observe.
Yes, but to what purpose?
Before Anila could explain, the coach rattled to a stop and the footman arrived at the door. The kings disembarked first, and then Anila, Davud, Xander, and several silver spears. They went into the palace and down 7 levels deep before arriving at a sculpted archway. A natural cavern lay beyond. The spears held lanterns, lighting their way, but it was Sukru who guided them, telling the spears which way to turn. Ever downward they went, moving closer. Davud was sure to the cavern he'd seen in his vision. Sure enough, nearly an hour into their journey through the underbelly of Sharakai, they came to a tunnel choked with thin tendrils. The roots of the Adhikara trees and the tunnel led to the massive cavern Davud had seen in his vision. All who had come, even the kings, stared in wonder. The vast space, the roots, the narrowing braid at the top of the cavern, and the glowing crystal beneath it. They walked carefully over the spongy surface of the roots, occasionally hearing the patter of softly glowing liquid dropping onto the crystal. King Cahill began walking around the cavern, taking it in step by step, while Sukru stared intently at the crystal, his face mere inches from it. King Husamatin spoke in low tones to Xander, while sending dark glances toward the crystal, Davud and Anila. King Kiral turned to Davud.
You saw this in the blooming fields.
He had a deep voice, resonant, but it sounded deadened in this place, as if it were the last place in the world and everything else had gone.
I did, my lord king.
Do you know its purpose?
I do not, Davud replied. Only that the roots of all the Adhikara end up here.
Behind Kiral, Sukru held his fingers flat, pressed them near the crystal. He was careful not to touch the surface, however. There was something about it. Davud could feel it, even several paces away. It was cold, the sort that chilled one's very soul.
You'll try your spell again,
Sukru said without even looking at Davud. He pointed to a spot a few paces away.
Prepare yourself.
Of course, my lord king, Davud replied.
You!
Sukru snapped his fingers at his guardsman Xander.
Give him what he needs.
The kings stepped away and they chatted softly with one another. Davud knelt on the roots and Xander sat cross-legged before him. Xander had always struck him as a brave sort, a man accustomed to battle, but the muscles along his neck were tight and his eyes focused squarely on Davud's, as if he feared to look anywhere else.
I won't take much, Davud said softly.
You'll take all you need, Sukru cut in. He is willing to die for Shadokai. And you,
he snapped at Anila.
Watch. Learn.
Take all you need,
Xander echoed, holding his knife out. Embarrassed over speaking loudly enough for the king to hear, Davud took the knife, doing his best to ignore Anila.
Very well.
He used the point of the knife to pierce Xander's wrist. With the blood that welled, he drew the same sigils he'd used in the desert, first on his left palm, then on his right. As he touched Xander's blood once more, ready to lift it to his tongue, he felt his mouth go suddenly dry. The hairs on his arms and the back of his neck stood up. He felt as though something or someone was standing at his back, ready to touch him. When he flinched and turned, he saw only the kings and the silver spears standing in a meandering line, but the troubled looks on their faces, even the kings, only heightened the sense that something was very, very wrong. He and Xander both stood. Davud felt a growing desire to flee, but he stifled the urge as he felt a soft breeze pick up and circulate through the cavern. Motes of dust flew about, scintillant in the crystal's soft glow. As one, the kings and spears turned toward a tunnel on the cavern's far side. Davud felt it as well. A presence nearing, powerful as the great Shangazi. It was vast and deep, but it felt strange, as if it didn't belong below the earth, but soaring through the sky like one of Thash's great eagles, or roaming the towering mountains that ringed the desert like Baki's fabled ram. In ones and twos, moths with iridescent red wings exited the tunnel. More came, and then more, until a stream of them spilled into the cavern, circling in the same direction as the glowing dust. In their wake strode a woman. She was tall, like the first men and women. She towered above even Kiral and Husamatine. Her lustrous black hair was held in place with an ebony comb, carved to look like the spread wings of an amber lark. Her olive skin glistened. Hot tears slid down Davud's cheeks. Emotions welled up from deep inside him, growing with every step she took and swirling in a way that somehow mirrored the cloud of moths. Her face was so comely, so serene, he felt inadequate to look upon her. Clusters of the crimson moths adorned her frame, their wings beating like hearts. As she moved, some lifted into the air, momentarily exposing a breast, her thighs, her stomach, her sex. Fine blue sandals adorned her feet, the moths lifting and landing with every footfall. She was a goddess, Davud was sure. Not Tulathan, nor Rhea, for it was said their skin glowed silver and golden. But Yerinde, goddess of love, goddess of ambition, who'd stolen Tulathan from the sky until she had been rescued by Rhea. As she approached, the kings knelt, as did the silver spears and Xander. Davud, however, forgot himself. He stared openly until Anila stepped beside him, tugged on his wrist, and knelt before the goddess. Even then Davud only took one knee. He couldn't take his eyes from her. He knew it to be blasphemous, knew she could strike him down for the affront, but he could no more take his eyes from her than he could rip his heart from his chest. She stared at him, drinking in his form, as if he were a curiosity, an orchid growing in the desert. Her eyes were violet. They shone brightly in the light of the nearby crystal, deep and knowing, as if they had witnessed the making of the world. He felt naked before her, defenseless, not in body but in mind. He was a babe before a demon. At last she turned her gaze on the kings, and Davud felt a release inside him, an unshackling. Her lips were sealed, but Davud heard her command resonate within his mind. Rise. As one, the kings stood, while all others remained on bended knee. Yerinde motioned to the crystal. Moths fluttered and returned to her.
Thou hast come to see what the Adhikara hath wrought.
It was Keral who answered.
We have come, Lady of Love, because the Adhikara have shown signs of weakness, as have the Asiram.
Are the Asiram not bound to the Adhikara? Does their death not breathe sickness upon bough and branch?
Keral paused. Davud dared look up.
It may be as you say. Dost thou doubt my word?
Never. But we had reason to believe that this, he motioned to the glowing crystal, was the cause. Not the Asiram.
What reason?
This young man was granted visions of the roots leading here. We thought...
Even the mighty King Keral seemed cowed by Yerinde's presence.
We had need to know the truth.
Truth.
Dimples formed in Yerinde's cheeks as she smiled.
A word with many meanings.
Her gaze slid past Keral to rest on Davud. She approached him. The moths flying about her frame filled the air with a soft fluttering sound that perfectly matched the feelings inside Davud's stomach. She smelled of vetiver and sweet grass.
Visions,
she said.
Yes,
Davud replied.
Wouldst thou give them to me?
Davud swallowed, clearing his mouth of spit.
If you will it.
Yerinde's smile widened, revealing perfect teeth.
Oh, but I do.
And with that, she touched a finger to his forehead. With that touch came an excitement and a fear and a love so deep, Davud's heart could hardly contain it. He relived the visions from Tulathan's, giving life to the blooming fields, to Nalame kneeling before them, to Gojan and the black laughers attacking her as she tried to flee.
Nalame, came Arinde's voice. She who meddles in the will of the kings of the desert, the will of the gods.
Yes,
Davud said.
Yes,
Keral echoed a moment later. And Yerinde turned to him.
A plague Has she been on thy rule?
Yes,
Kiral said again, though with less conviction than a moment before. She approached Kiral and the other three kings, looking at each of them in turn, as she had Davood, as if deciding which one to devour.
Thy wish is for thy reign to continue, for the Adhikara to thrive, for the Asiram to remain thy loyal servants.
Kiral glanced to Sukru on his left, Cahill on his right.
We do, my lady goddess.
Then bring me her head.
The kings seemed shocked.
Her head?
Kiral said.
The head of she who has wronged thee.
Nalame?
Yirinde smiled. Kiral swallowed. A man so powerful, now cowed, unsure of himself.
Of course, my lady.
He pulled himself taller, then worked his jaw before speaking again.
So it shall be.
Yirinde looked to Sukru, who nodded, then Cahill, who nodded as well, and finally Husamitin, who took much longer but in the end fell in line with his brother kings.
Very well,
Yirinde said, then turned and strode away. She paused near the crystal, regarding it as if admiring her own handiwork. Whether she was pleased or not, Davood couldn't say. She left the cavern, more and more flowing red moths trailing in her wake, until they too were gone, and the kings and spears and Davood and Anila were alone once more. For long moments no one said a word. Cahill stared at the tunnel where Yirinde had walked. Sukru looked at the crystal as if his curiosity had been piqued, and he desperately wished to examine it further. King Kiral saw, however, and shook his head.
You will cease your investigations into the Adhikara. Immediately.
Sukru's pinched face looked crestfallen. His mouth worked, as if he were trying to find the right words to convince Kiral otherwise. But before he could, Kiral turned and strode back the way they'd come, leaving the rest to follow or risk his wrath. Sukru glared at Davood as if he had been the one to deny him his prize.
You heard your king,
he snapped, then followed Kiral from the cavern. Soon they were walking back through the tunnels, up toward the Sun Palace, the weight of their bargain, to kill a god, resting heavily on all their shoulders.
Chapter 28. Deep in the desert, in a tower made of stone, a boy named Brahma lies naked on a cold slab of rock. A bloody kenshar rests on his stomach, its obscene weight rising and falling with every breath. Marking the skin along his ribs are wounds that no longer bleed openly, but they weep. A normal man's wounds might become infected, but not Brahma's. For his mistress will not allow him to die. Not so easily as this. His entire body wants to coil like sunburned leather when he hears her approach. Her hooves clap against the stone stairs. Her forked tail whips and slaps against the spiraling stairwell in rhythms that speak of chaos and pain. As her tall form ducks through the archway on the far side of the room, Brahma cringes, but does not move. His mistress has forbidden it. She comes closer, her smiling face revealed. Her ebony skin, her crown of thorns, her sweeping ram's horns. All ruddy in the light from the banked coals of the brazier in the corner.
And here we are again. She says in a voice as deep as a veil.
She trails her ebony claws across his fresh wounds, eliciting a wince.
Though I wonder, have you learned your lesson?
He swallows, ignoring the pain of that simple movement. Ignoring the fact that he should be incensed that it does cause him pain.
I have, mistress.
She paces around the slab, her rust-colored eyes never leaving his.
We shall see. Sit up. Take the knife.
He feels a release. His limbs are his own once more, as is his will. He can obey or disobey as he chooses. He could run from the room. He could try, as he has many other times, to fling himself from the nearby window. But he knows the ways of his mistress's mind. How he prayed in the early days that Baki would come for him. How he wished the god of final sunsets would show mercy and usher him to the farther fields. He had run for that window in the past, to meet Baki and to pass beyond these shores, but each time Rumayesh stopped him, forced him to crash into the walls, to batter his body until he had collapsed from the pain. Months passed before he attempted it again. Only a week ago he had tried, thinking he had finally caught her off guard. He learned that he hadn't only after she had allowed him his leap. Through the window he had flown, joyous, triumphant, his arms spread like the wings of a swan as he rushed toward courtyard below and his own demise. When his body met the flagstones, he was not granted the mercy of blacking out. He felt every moment of it, each broken bone, each tear in his flesh. Moments later, in a swirl of sand and sighing wind, Rumayesh joined him. He stared up at her, feeling the warmth of his blood as it leaked from a dozen wounds, praying he'd soon be freed. She had watched with mirth in her eyes, content in the knowledge that he had not escaped her this way. As the painful reality of it dawned on him, his body began to mend. His bones realigned themselves loudly with intense pain. His joints popped into place. His skin moved in strange and sudden increments, creating a maddening itch all over his body, as if a host of scarabs had been sewn up inside him. Tears mingled with the blood on the stone beneath him.
Leave me be,
he pleaded.
Leave me be.
All the while Rumayesh stared, her inhuman eyes brimming with satisfaction. As she had so many times before and in so many different ways, she had tricked him. She had crafted the illusion that if he could reach the window, he would be allowed to die. And when the illusion had been made perfect, she let him leap, knowing full well he would remain by her side for as long as she wished. Lying on the slab, he wonders why she enjoys it so. Had her cruelty been passed to her by her maker Gojin? Was it an inseparable part of alchemy used in her making? Or is it simple fascination, a way for her to measure the stuff of mortals, who to a creature such as her were little different than the rattlewings that infest the oases?
Do you disobey?
Rumayesh asks him.
No,
he replies immediately.
Never!
As he takes the knife from his belly and rises, his mind scratches at the question that's been hounding him since he fell into her hands.
What will it take for me to die?
He wants it so, but the very thought of angering her makes his soul quake. Rumayesh stares deeply into his eyes, saying nothing. He swallows, wanting to remain silent, knowing that he mustn't.
What is your desire, my mistress?
Why, whatever it is you desire, Brahma.
And then she waits, savoring the disquiet in his mind. His growing fear of the torture to come. This is the game. She wants enough of his pain to be sated, but asks him to choose how much. Give too little,
and she'd take the rest and more. Give too much, and he'll have tortured himself for nothing. This is what she enjoys the most. Not merely the pain itself, but the indecision. The weighing up of misery to square a ledger he knows nothing and can know nothing about. It is a cup from which she drinks deeply, like a lord of Golden Hill on the finest Arrak.
If I could turn the tables, if I could stand where you stand now.
The moment the treacherous thoughts come, he smothers them. Were she to hear them?
Tell me, Brahma,
she coos.
What is your desire?
To die, to leave the desert behind, to walk amongst the green grasses of the farther fields.
But he cannot say such things. Voicing them would anger her. Worse, however, would be to give in to the temptation. That is what she desires most, to give him hope of being free that she might take it from him.
Tears slip down his cheeks. I wish to make you happy.
Oh, and how will you do that?
His tears make him feel weak, which allows him to grip the knife harder and drive it into his thigh. A tremulous exhalation of pain pours from his throat as the knife sinks deep. He keeps as much of it in as he can. It is an offering of sorts, for he knows how much she enjoys it, him facing his pain bravely despite the suffering that lies ahead. Her eyes brighten. She smiles a jackal smile, then leans close and runs her tongue along his thigh, lapping at the blood he's shed. She kneels before him, a shiver running through her, then whispers,
"Yes."
She grips his knees, spreads his legs farther apart until her head is between his thighs.
"Yes."
She licks again. When he drives the knife into his other leg, her head arches back.
"Yes."
She bares her neck to him, daring him to run the blade across her throat. But he doesn't. He can't.
How could he?
The things she would do to him if he tried. So he grits his teeth and goes on, stabbing deeper, offering more of his lifeblood to the demon licking his skin like a lustful wife. Stabbing again, he prays that when enough has been spilled, she'll allow him to fall unconscious.
Brahma!
Somewhere not too far away, Brahma heard soft scraping sounds. A chair over dirt. Shoes over stone. It came nearer, louder, and then,
"Dear God, no! Brahma!"
Someone gripped his shoulders and shook him. A sunrise of pain blossomed along the horizon of his mind, then hands pressed against his cheeks, the fingers cradling his neck.
"Please, Brahma, wake!"
Brahma forced his eyes open and found Jax kneeling over him. For some reason, her dirty face registered before her terrified expression. Her eyes were wide as teacups. For him, he assumed, though he couldn't understand why. He did a moment later, as Jack stood and shouted for help. Lighting the small cellar was the thin yellow light of a candle that sat halfway up the nearby stairwell. It lit the stain of muddy red that spread like a fan from where Brahma lay. From his prone vantage, it looked like a kicking mule.
"My blood,"
Brahma realized.
"That's all my blood."
A vision of Rumayesh, laughing, danced before his eyes.
"Brahma!"
Gods, he'd fallen asleep again. How very difficult it was to remain awake. If only he might sleep a while, forcing his eyes open was like lifting a 10 stone.
"Brahma, please!"
She was shaking him again.
"Wake up!"
"I'm well,"
he wanted to say, though he was anything but. He tried to speak, but all that came out was a strange, wet gurgle. That, finally, was what spurred him to movement. He sounded like a bellows doused in yogurt.
He was going to die unless he got help. Gingerly he probed his neck. Like a beacon fire being lit, a terrible burning sensation rose up all along his throat. Pain he could handle. It was the depth of the cut that scared him. Would he lose his voice? Each time he probed further, his fingers came away sticky. The wound went all along the front of his neck, he realized. A cut that should have ended his life, but hadn't.
Listen to me.
Tears were streaming down Jax's cheeks.
I'm here. We're going to go home, the two of us. But I have to get help first.
She began to rise, but Brahma grabbed her wrist. He flicked his gaze meaningfully to the wall where the Chimeri had been chained. Jax looked back, her jaw jutting in anger or shock, or both.
He's gone.
Of course he was. He'd slit Brahma's throat and left. Brahma knew he should feel angry, but he didn't. In truth, he wasn't sure how to feel. Grateful to be alive? Despondent over being kept once more from the farther fields? Filled with a desire for revenge on the Chimeri for trying to kill him? He stared at Jax, wondering why the Chimeri hadn't run a knife across her throat. There was a nasty bruise along her neck, a wound sustained as the Chimeri tried to escape. He was grateful, he decided. Jax was still alive. She didn't deserve death for his fool actions. He tried sitting up, but Jax pushed him down.
You bloody fool! I'm going to get help. Just rest until I return.
He held his hand up to forestall her, then felt for his necklace and the sapphire. The falcon's egg gemstone had been his constant companion for years. It was the source of his power, the home of his enemy. He crawled over the floor, running his hands wildly over the packed earth. The emptiness inside him told him it was gone. But it didn't feel possible. Jax helped him search, but it was half-hearted. She knew as well as he that the Chimeri had taken it. Jax stared at him with an expression of terror or worry, perhaps both. As painful as Brahma's life had been, the gem meant much to them both. They'd used it to forge a life here in Sharakai. Likely she was already wondering what life would be like if they no longer had it. There was a fury inside Brahma for having the gem stolen from him. But a part of him, the part that had been subjected to months of torture at the hands of Umayesh, felt relieved. No longer was it needling him every waking moment. No longer would he have to face the one who had been so cruel to him. No matter that they'd come to an accord years ago. No matter that Brahma was now the master and Rumayesh the prisoner. His neck itched terribly. Instead of scratching it, he looked down and began dusting off his bloody clothes. Why he bothered, he wasn't sure. They were hopelessly soiled and caked in dried and still drying blood. Not knowing what else to do, he headed for the stairs and promptly fell over.
Oh, gods!
Jax helped him back up, then wrapped his arm across her shoulders and helped him climb the stairs. Under a cloak of starlight, they trudged along the dead-end street in the knot the two of them called home. These were Brahma's buildings, all purchased as part of his growing empire, fueled by his use of the sapphire. Few of his chosen were up at this hour, but those who were stared at him in horror. There was an unmistakable note of wonder in their eyes as well. They'd thought Brahma untouchable. He'd never wished for it, but he had become their idol. And now the pillar upon which they had placed him was beginning to crumble. As they reached home, Jax and several others helped remove his filthy clothes. They cleaned him and stitched his wounds and gave him fresh robes. They guided him up to his room on the topmost floor, looking as though they were ready to die in his place, asking what they might do for him. But he had no answers. He was no hero, no savior. He was a thief who had stumbled across a bauble that had granted him indescribable power. None of it had ever been his, not really. It had always been ephemeral, ready to slip through his fingers like so much sand. And now that it had, he felt strangely free, as if it had always been a prison, but it had taken this for him to realize it. He waved away their questions, then took Jax's hand and led her to their bed. As he held her, he pretended that he was some other man, a proper man with a proper wife, a man who got up and went about his day in the Amber City like any other. A locksmith, perhaps. He almost laughed at the thought.
What?
Jax whispered. As Brahma shook his head, she looked at the bandages around his neck and laid her head back down. He stroked her hair, falling into that very dream. He and Jax, living a normal life. Holding that dream to him like a talisman, he slept, blissfully free of the nightmares that so often plagued him. When morning broke, Brahma rose from bed, probing his neck to feel how well the cut had healed. It was coming along well. Only a dull pain remained. Another few days and it would be just another scar to add to the rest. He went to the nearby window and stared down over the courtyard, which in truth was nothing more than a dead end in the most convoluted and densely packed section of the city. His acolytes were there, the servants of a false god, speaking to those who had come for healing. They came with bread in hand, a bit of watered wine. Some even had real money. They gave it over to Tuaro, the rangy Kunduni with the wild eyes, a man who had remained here even after his brother had been killed in Brahma's service, or Shay, the young Moraean woman who had arrived shaking so badly from the call of the lotus, Brahma had doubted he could save her. A knock came at the door.
Come,
he said in a harsh rasp. Speaking brought on a sharp burn along his throat, but it was manageable. Jax entered and joined him by the window. She considered the courtyard as Brahma was doing, but given how troubled she looked, Brahma very much doubted she was having the same thoughts.
Already they come,
she said, jutting her chin toward the end of the street, where a young man wearing only threadbare trousers was walking toward Shay, shaking as bad as a newborn lamb.
So we help him,
he whispered.
And how will we do that? A bed to sleep in, lotus tea to ease the pain, a bit of food to help with the cramps.
Jax nodded as if she agreed, but he could tell she was working up to something. He had a very good idea what it was.
We may ease his pain, she said. We may provide succor to the others. But how long would they continue to come when they learned you've lost your power? How long can we afford to buy lotus tea when fewer come with coin? Or provide beds, for that matter, and those to attend them? We have money set aside. And how long will that last?
They both knew it would last only a few months, less if their donations began to dwindle. He might have had more, but he had been focused on buying all the buildings along this dead-end street, and it had become more expensive the closer he had come to getting them all. The last few slumlords holding out for higher prices. Brahma had hardly haggled with them. At the time it felt important to gain the whole street so he could better secure it. Now he felt the fool, but he hadn't expected to lose Rumayesh. He'd always thought he'd have trouble from the Silver Spears, or the House of Kings, a question of diplomacy and graft, not blades, before he'd face a challenge from the streets.
We'll sell a few of the buildings. We'll ration,
Brahma swallowed, reflexively wincing from the pain it brought on.
We'll ration the supplies. Stretch them further.
That will only further the rumors that the tattered prince has lost his power. And you're mad if you think you'll get even a quarter of what you paid for these hovels. Especially when those greedy bastards get wind of what's happening in their old territory.
She was right about all of it. He swallowed again.
We'll find a way, Jax.
You're going to let him go, then? Let that chimeri worm take everything from us?
Brahma regarded her levelly as he took her by the shoulders.
You don't understand. He's freed me from her.
Brahma, I know what you've been through with Rumayesh, but you must see it. The chimeri has set a plague of termites beneath our home. Mark my words. They will eat away at the foundation of all we've built. And sooner than you think...
She waved to the window.
They're already talking about what happened.
Losing her was always a possibility.
Jax's mouth fell open.
That man tried to kill you. And I was prepared to kill him to get what I wanted.
He must pay for it.
She was right, of course. It was dangerous, especially here in the shallows, to let challenges go unanswered. The sapphire had been stolen from him, taken forcibly, his throat slit for good measure. Part of him wanted to stave the Chimeri's head in for doing it, but another part of him felt free in a way that he hadn't since having the misfortune of stumbling into Rumayesh's path. He told himself nearly every day since that he was keeping the sapphire, keeping Rumayesh, for good reasons, to keep the Erek's power from those who would use it for ill purposes, and so that he could use it to heal those who needed it most. But deep down, he'd known that Rumayesh had been doing it only on a whim. She didn't care about him, not truly. Nor did she care about those they'd healed, those they'd helped in the knot and beyond. For her, it was merely a way to satisfy her curiosity. What was this enslavement to her in any case? She had centuries to live. So why shouldn't he, Brahma, now live his life as he chose? Why should he care if some chimeri had stolen her away?
Haven't you had your fill of revenge?
Brahma asked.
Have you forgotten where it leads?
Jax had lost her brother to his thirst for revenge. He had been the rightful heir in Malasan, and had his title stolen out from under him when a pair of conspiring lords had killed his mother and father. He and Jax had fled to Sharakai, chased by assassins. Her brother hadn't been able to relinquish his thirst for revenge, and had lost his life because of it. Jax had been different. She had reconciled herself with her fate, and had stood by Brahma's side ever since.
Don't dredge up the past and lay it before me, as if you remember it better than I do.
She threw her hands up in the air, indicating the house they stood in, the courtyard beyond, the buildings that surrounded it, all filled with those recovering from their addictions, or those who had decided to stay after being healed.
We built this, Brahma. It's something to be proud of. I won't just let it go.
Proud,
Brahma scoffed.
It's a haven for those with one foot in the grave.
She stared at him aghast.
You don't believe that.
Do you know how many return after we've healed them?
Jax's jaw was set grimly, her eyes flat.
Perhaps you haven't seen, or perhaps you haven't cared to. But for every 5 that leave, 4 return. We deliver them back to their lives. But be it soon or late, the lotus resumes its siren song.
And the one that makes it out,
I thought those were the ones you were fighting for, and the others to give them a chance.
He rubbed his temples absently. A terrible headache was coming on.
We still can.
Jax shook her fists in the air.
Make up your mind, Brahma Judanava! Do you want to help them, or have you given up?
I don't know.
Well, you better sort it out before the decision is made for you.
She left, slamming the door behind her. Brahma's headache raged throughout the morning, continued as a dull ache throughout the day, echoing the defeated looks of those who stared at him. Without fail, their eyes wandered to his neck, to the thick bandage, the place where his necklace and its massive sapphire had once rested. He nearly left that very day to procure another, a fake that could pass for the old one. But he knew it would deceive no one, least of all him. It would make him a fool, an idiot dancing on the back of a pony, calling himself a knight. That night he heard the news. Two of his disciples had left, slipped away without saying a word to anyone, taking nearly all their black lotus tea with them when they left. When he fell asleep at last, it was fitful. The dreams filled with torture and mirthful demon eyes had returned.
Chapter 29.
Chayda listened carefully, her ear pressed against the surface of a hidden door in the pitch-black tunnel. Hearing nothing, she pulled the handle she'd become familiar with while at the House of Maidens and slid the door aside. Beyond was a Savasham, where Zaid had trained her. It was empty, though she could hear voices beyond the rice paper doors on the far side of the room. Being careful to avoid the boards that creaked, she stepped onto the wooden floor, then slid the door shut behind her, cringing at the dull thud. She moved to the doors opposite and listened. As the voices faded, she slid through the door, then glided along the hallway like a ghost. At the far side of the matron's building, she heard the sound she remembered. That boom, whenever the Hall of Records entranceway was closed. She went up two stories to the rarely used office of Sayabim, her old sword mistress. Dust-coated scrolls and papers that littered every flat space along the shelves and desk. For a woman so fastidious about swordplay, it was surprising how untidy Sayabim left her room. It was perfect for Chayda, though, as it overlooked the House of Maidens' interior wall. Peering through the window, Chayda saw it, only a short leap down. Beyond, the whole of Toriat's southeastern face was revealed. The sun had set, but the thin white clouds in the slate-coloured sky were lit a brilliant orange. They made it look as if the sky were a fire, ready to fall upon the palaces of the kings above. Chayda unwound the length of rope she had tied around her waist, secured one end to the stout curtain hook above the window, then tested it for strength. The other end she coiled below the window with all the care of a boatswain with the rigging lines. Then, from one of the pouches at her belt, she pulled out a spool of dark grey thread with an already threaded needle sticking out of it, which she used to string the thread through one end of the rope. Then she sat and waited. As the brightness along the western horizon extinguished, she tugged her mother's locket out. The locket was once again filled with petals, gifts from Leora before she had left. She left them hidden away. The Asurum might sense her. It would be the height of foolishness to take them when all depended on her presence in the House of Kings remaining secret. But she did rub the locket while whispering to her mother.
Guide me this night. Lead me to the answers I need.
Silver Tulathan rose over the desert. Rhea's golden disk was not far behind. She heard the first of the Asurum soon after, A long, lonely wail that set her skin prickling. Another wail came shortly after, softer, more distant than the third, this one closer.